Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Tyler Crumrine and Austin Walker. Tyler is the founder of Possible Worlds Games and the Annie Award-winning designer of Beak, Feather, and Bone, Details of Our Escape, and, my personal favorite, Scene Themes. Austin is the host of the beloved actual play podcast, Friends at the Table. Also the co-host of the Star Wars podcast, A More Civilized Age, and most presciently for today's conversation, the designer of Realis, an innovative new TTRPG that is being published by Possible Worlds Games. Tyler, Austin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us, Brian. You could have a career as an announcer at sporting events. Mm-hmm. I would love to hear you tell old people in a theater to unwrap their candy now before the play starts. Just really a command of the intro, get them out of the way.
Yeah, I was wrapped. I was ready to, I thought there might be more people to introduce. I was just ready to just more introductions, you know?
Oh, I've got more introductions. Oh, we can do more. Yeah, I'll wait for more. Elliot just cut me off.
Yeah.
He does have a great voice for radio.
I've got a great face for radio too, let me tell you. Hey, buddy. It's so great to have you both on. We've been really excited to talk to, honestly, Tyler, we've been friends with you for a little bit and love talking about Possible Worlds Games and your big announcement of this slate of 12 games over the next 3 years that you're going to be publishing. And Austin, having just read Realis and reread it this last night, this game is so fucking cool.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. I'm happy to have it out there. I'm happy to have people getting to see the stuff that has been bouncing around my head for years now.
Yeah, and it's been really encouraging, too, that it's been a couple of months now since that Ashcan came out. And as exciting as it was to have that very early adoption, you know, all of the people that were like, oh, my gosh, this is great, you know, day one getting in on it based on the fact that, you know, they either like the stuff that Possible Worlds does or they like the stuff that Austin does. But to see people continuing to discover the game and like recommend it to friends and like running their own campaigns and creating like custom classes and hacks and things like that, it's really encouraging, you know, even just as creators with reputations in the space to see that like, oh, we're not kind of coasting off previous work. This is something that people are meeting and engaging with on its own terms, and really, it's resonating with them.
For me, the moment where I knew I had made the thing I'd hoped I had made was the Moon Jam. There was a jam over on itch.io hosted by Ham Ham Bone. Shout outs to Ham Ham Bone.
Shout out Ham Ham Bone.
And there were like 51 entries, which is way more than, so for people who don't know, moons in Realis are sort of locations or settings that have a number of sentences, which are really broadly sort of like aspects or something in Fate. And they're really flavorful and they're really mechanically interesting in the way that they can be used by both players and GM, and in the way that they can create a place in play. They don't come pre-written necessarily. The GM might have some, but players can spend a resource to create their own and add them to the moon. And they cover a whole location, whether that is a literal moon or a space station, or sometimes they can be a subpart of a moon, like a dungeon. And so some of these had more than one moon also. Like, so some of these had like five moons. And so total, I think there's probably like 60, 70 moons out there just in fan material, not only the three that come in the ash can. And of course, there'll be more in the full release when we get to that. But that was like, oh yeah, good. People get it. This is, you know, when creating Realis as a game, I had to be very careful about not over-focusing on quote-unquote content and making sure that I spent a lot of time on design and including that content needed to be designed sometimes. It needed to suggest how the game could be played or modified or added to through the inclusion of sentences and impulses and stuff that led the reader and the player to understand how they could twist the core rules through those sentences. And also, the reason I say that is because it's just fun to write sentences. It's just fun to come up with a moon or a class or whatever in Realis. And so seeing that fun immediately spark a jam and get all of these entries was just like, yep, good, got it, good. This part of it at the very least works. I'm not sitting in on these games necessarily, but I'm seeing that people are engaging in the part of it that is a sort of prompt to create worlds and to create character types and stuff like that. So at that point, I was like, all right, cool. Okay, good. It's landing. It's working.
It's working. It's doing it.
For the uninitiated, could we real quick get the elevator pitch of what is Realis? Because I think that, you know, probably most people listening are really excited about it. But let's just get the quick, like, let's get the quick definition out of the way. What is Realis for the uninitiated?
Realis is a tabletop role-playing game that is focused on what I've increasingly started to call a system of subtractive progression.
Ooh, nice.
Characters begin with big, bold, archetypical sentences, a set of them that define what their character can do. Think of those like skills or attributes in another game, but here they are short sentences that are always written with an always. So for instance, the berserker has, I always kill my foe. Actually, let me do one that's not about killing, because I think that's fun. I had to explain this to some people recently where I was like, I don't want to lead with the one that I always lead with, which is kill it, which is I always kill my foe, because that one is so, people have a certain idea of what a space fantasy tabletop role-playing game can be. And so instead of that, let's go with the pedagogue, who is a sort of annoying teacher. The pedagogue has a sentence, I always get my point across. So if there's a situation where in the story where you wanted to convince someone to break up with their bad boyfriend, the pedagogue could say, I'm going to lay out my argument for why you should break up with your bad boyfriend and use, I always get my point across. Now, you're using that in the place of like a persuade skill or something. In Realis, the way it works is the person who's acting says the sentence that they're going to use. And then the person someone who doesn't want that to happen can try to counteract that action, right? That sentence by suggesting their own sentence. The defender wins on ties. At the beginning of the game, most sentences are +0. They're +0 sentences. And so someone else might use the sentence, I always find the story. Let's say they're a news hound. They're this kind of journalist type. So the pedagogue character says, I always get my point across. I'm arguing you with reason and facts. But the news hound says, I always get the story. And so I realize that you're not arguing with news and facts. You're actually reflecting some deep trauma from your past. I can see through the thing that you're doing. Now, over time, as you fail, you mark those sentences and they get to a point where they're called primed. After they failed 3 times and the rules as written, you can realize them. They go from being a +0 sentence to a +1 sentence, which seems additive. But the reason it's subtractive is at the moment that you do that, you have to add some sort of falsifiable clause to the sentence. You can't just be, I always get my point across. It could become, when talking to someone one-on-one, I always get my point across. Or when I have gathered information first, I always get my point across. Or when I'm talking to someone from the Lyceum, the Zvezd Lyceum, my own proper noun's getting the best of me. Like, okay, inside of the small subgroup of scholars, I always get my point across. And then that happens multiple times. So by the end of the game, what you have is a character who used to be able to kill everything on sight or always get their point across. But now they need certain circumstances to use that ability. Maybe I always get my point across when talking to a friend one-on-one at night. And so suddenly you need to start like building with the rest of your set of sentences, which also includes certain things like ephemera, which are special objects or alliances or kind of temporary bonuses, bonds between characters, your group, your band has a sentence together. All of those things can help you kind of conspire a moment for your very powerful sentences to come into effect, right? Or you could do the great thing of letting those limits lead you into failure or lead you into more drama, right? That is the gist of it on the mechanics front. Fictionally, as you've kind of heard a little bit, it's science fantasy. There are living spaceships and ancient oratories and, you know, libraries floating around. There's 1,000 moons orbiting a planet that's an irradiated blue no one has ever come back from. Big, weird, you know, space warlocks happening, all that stuff. All the stuff that I have loved for a long time. So, yeah, that's the pitch on Realis.
So it's a game where you can have a sentence that is like, I always kill my foe, or you can have an even stronger sentence like, I always defend my bad boyfriend when he's wearing the little suit.
When he's wearing the little suit. Yeah, but only if he's wearing the little suit.
Only if he's wearing the little suit. It wouldn't be like you're really a plus one sentence otherwise.
Exactly. Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
And one of the things that's really nice about that structure is, you know, it is a game that in its systems teach you how to be a better storyteller. In some ways, like, teaches you how to be a designer, too. I think part of why we saw that initial Moon Jam is that it's not that hard to wrap your brain around, like, okay, so as it becomes stronger, it gets more specific. And so that applies to the moons that people are creating too, where they might have like a basic sentence for their moon that is, you know, lost items always come back or something like that, which might be a plus zero sentence. Or you could have a plus one sentence that might be like, under the cover of night, danger always looms, or, you know, citizens of this moon always do this thing. And from a storytelling perspective, it also guides people into becoming more specific in how they think about their character. And, you know, making sure that as the story progresses and as the story kind of narrows in on what it is that your GM cares about, that your players care about, their characters are also going to narrow in on like, all right, what are you capable of? What kind of situations do you want to put yourself in to have the greatest amount of success?
This is the subtractive part, right? Just to be clear, because I kind of said that and then moved past it. But like, you know, certain types of sculpture are subtractive. You start with the marble block, you start chipping away at it, you shape what was already there, this kind of big, bold thing, into something smaller, more discreet, more specific. And that can happen with characters, but also, as Tyler, like you're saying, with moons, some of my favorite moments in playtesting have been when something changes about how a moon works because a moon sentence gets primed and realized, right? Let's say like the moon is like, the moon's name is Bala. I'm making this up, and it's like, Bala citizens always throw parties. And then like, but it realizes eventually, and then you add like, after a war, Bala citizens always throw parties, or at night, or on, you know, when there's an eclipse, and suddenly you've limited the sentence in this really narrative way that will stick with the group forever. And it also makes it so you can't just use it all the time, right? And for me, this is like part of the thing that I think has been, it's a thing I don't see a lot of in other games. And it's the thing that I kind of zeroed in on as like, oh, this is how this is, to go back to Tyler's point of like, the game hopefully making people, maybe not better storytellers, but learning how to tell different stories, which maybe that's technically making them a better storyteller. A lot of real stories are about this sort of increase in limitation, that you might gain strength in certain ways, but it means cutting yourself off from other things. Some stories are about that, doing that temporarily. I've always shouted out With Great Power, the tabletop game from the original version. I haven't played the more recent release. That's all about kind of like a superhero stories where, you know, in this story, Peter Parker is really interested in his career and his relationship, but his web-slinging is like diminishing because he's trying to really focus on his Peter Parker alias. And then other times that stuff suffers because he's really giving it to the streets as Spider-Man. That's a game about that stuff going up and down. But there's also other stories that are about this sort of long-term, slow shaping of a person into a different type of person than what they used to be. And that doesn't happen through the accumulation of new abilities, right? Like the way that, let's say, Frodo changes over the course of Lord of the Rings is not that he gets like plus 10 in sneak by the end of it. He diminishes over the course of that story. He starts as this boisterous person. And then by the end, he has things like, when I am with Sam, I can always do blank, right? Or when the objective is in sight, I can always do blank. And I wanted to capture that part of stories. Berserk obviously is the primary inspiration for me. And I think a lot of people eject from that, or they watch the anime, which ends like very early on in it, before that sort of work starts happening.
It ends at the trauma.
It ends at the trauma.
It ends at the, like, yes, the thing that is the impetus, yes, for the entire rest of the story, which is, how do you get over trauma?
Yeah, how do you grow? How do you realize yourself after having been primed by trauma?
And I think that, like, to what you said, I agree that it doesn't necessarily make people better storytellers in a, like, you know, capital B sense. But I do think that there's something unique about this system that it makes it hard for you to just kind of play, like, Fantasy Brian or Sci-Fi Elliot, you know, because you are thinking of a character that has their own kind of like very fixed motivations and skills that, like, maybe you start at a place that it reflects, you know, things that you care about or something like that, but your character is going to become more and more their own thing with their own motivations. So it gets you to kind of think in that storytelling sense of like, all right, it doesn't quite matter as much what I, Tyler, would do in this situation. And instead, I'm thinking about, you know, like my character, Franz, and, you know, what are their motivations and how do those motivations impact what they're actually able to do at the table.
I've got a big thing about like on-ramps and like activation energies for getting into new tabletop role-playing games, because it's often such a big lift. And this has such a built-in way of doing that, both from a world-building perspective and a character-building perspective of like, you know, let me just pull up a class here. So the esoteric, reading just that word, I have a vague I know what esoteric means, but I don't know what that class is. I read four sentences of, I always amaze with my mastery of the magical. I always bring my collection of mystical curiosa. I always have the ear of a potential patron. I always play with forces beyond my control. That's such an easy on-ramp for me. Like, I can get into that. And then throughout play, where you're really starting to learn and understand what a character is, then you're shaping. Whereas a lot of games ask you to do, like, have a clear definition of your character and, like, you know, have that finished Michelangelo sculpture before you even get the block of marble.
Totally. Or you go the other way, right? Because the other thing that this is in conversation with for me are belonging outside belonging, no dice, no masters games, obviously Dream Askew, Dream Apart. Those are games in which you have a set of moves you can make with tokens, and then they stay the same for the whole game. And generally speaking, when I've played games in that style, they have been one-shots or, you know, one arc, you know, multiple play sessions, but you're recording a single arc of that character. There's no sense of progression in the way that we talk about progression in tabletop games. That is not to diminish that game. That game is incredible. I think that many of the games that have developed off of it have, and some of them do even have versions of progression. But I wanted something that really asked players to think about how their character was changing, not how they were. I mean, progression is almost the wrong word. I'm not asking how are you progressing in a sort of linear upwards momentum growth, you know, way. I'm asking how are you changing, right? How are you becoming different than you were at the start of the thing? You know, the thing that happens at the very end of a character's life, after they get to a +3 sentence, the idea of adding a fourth, you know, clause becomes really unwieldy. And so early on in the design of it, I realized, oh, we should retire sentences. When you would get primed for your fourth realization, instead you get retired, the sentence gets retired. And so I always amazed with my mastery of the magical, which maybe became, you know, when I am surrounded with my ephemera and working to protect my allies against the imperial empest, I always amazed with my mastery of the magical. It goes to, I used to always amaze with my mastery of the magical, or once I always amazed with my mastery of the magical. And that's a +0 sentence. You can still use it, right? But it doesn't, you can't use it for you have to use it as, I used to have this ability. And maybe that still gives you insight into the current situation. You know what I mean?
And yeah, that says so much, if not more.
Right. Exactly. And so to me, that's that journey. And it starts with that little on-ramp. And then eventually you come back to, damn, I don't actually have the ability to realize this anymore. I've hit the peak of what this character could have been. And now, having failed one last time, I return to this other thing that is no less active in the world, but is different than where I was a moment ago. And I find that that's also something that I don't see a lot in tabletop games, is the idea of the rise and fall of a character, right? The idea of like, well, sometimes characters, and this is all over stories for people of all ages, right? The idea that like, there's, again, certain genres where you just keep going up, right? If you're going to be the martial arts master on the top of the mountain, maybe you just keep going up, right? But for many stories, you become the best wrestler in the promotion, and then eventually the wounds start to wear on you. And bit by bit, you get worse and worse and worse. You know, you've been climbing the corporate ladder, and then finally you meet a rival who takes you down a peg. You were once the great king, and now you live in diminished form. You still sit on the throne, but your voice does not have the boom it once had, for instance. Boom, a word that has been taken from us by the Costco guys. I can't say it without being annoyed by the terrible world that we live in. But anyway, like that sort of arc is something that I've also not seen represented outside of, you know, there are of course games that do this, right? I think even Blades in the Dark's use of stress and trauma can fit into there. A lot of Forge in the Dark games have that thing around personality and emotion and psychology, but rarely is it, okay, now you can't do the thing you did four sessions ago. It's past, you've moved past that part of your life, you know?
I love when a mechanic is like such a beautiful abstraction of a thing in real life. And I feel like, you have abstracted the requirement of a human life to make choices. Like, it's like, it's like, it's just like, you know, there's this abstraction of the fact that, like, yeah, like, there are sentences about me when I was a teenager that now are way more specific. Like, it's like, I like art. And it's like, now it's like, I like making art when it's game design, like, right, in a very specific way. You know what I mean?
There,
it's
are
like,
those, it's forks like, in that's life, just, for sure.
And I can't, and I'm not as good as the other art practices that I've put aside, but I'm way better at game design. It is just a, I don't have a question, but it's a really beautiful abstraction of this idea of, like, getting older and choosing paths. And, like, that doesn't mean you're worse off for it. It's like, you just are, like, you know, you're getting better at this very specific kind of doing it.
And I should say, what you get good at.
I don't think that that's necessarily the only way for real life to work.
Right.
You might pick up painting still, Elliot. Like,
yeah,
you could go become a different artist in real life. I don't believe that that's the case in real life. But I Austin Walker is not penning this game as Austin Walker. This is a game written by people inside of the setting itself, and they have a perspective about how the world works and how people work. They believe this is the reality that surrounds them, and they're representing that in a game to tell stories with each other. The word rights are a faction in the game. They're not, I don't think that they're actually represented as a faction in the Ashcan, but they're in the full text, the current playtest document. And they see the world a particular way. And that's what this game represents. We'll see how it goes. One day, I know how some other people see the world. I know how some other groups understand how the setting of Realis function, and they see it a completely different way. So I would love to one day have the time to, like, develop that.
Fascinating.
Out.
There's a line at the end of this game that I think encapsulates the entirety of how excited I am about this game. And it is, as we see it, the value of this game is the ease at which you can make it yours. And I've never read a sentence at an end of a game that I so thoroughly saw throughout the rest of the text. Like, every single bit of this text is devoted to that sentence. And then to have it summed up near the end of the game, I was like, boom, bold, highlight, yeah, that is going to go in the interview.
It's funny, Tyler and I had a lot of conversation about, so that's at the end of a page called Customizing Realis. And, you know, this is a pretty hefty book, at even as an Ashcan. It's 120-something pages. The bulk of that is the game, right? It's like 50 pages of rules and then 50 pages of classes and then like 13 pages of like GM facing content or something like that, right? Maybe it's a little bit different, but something like that. And we had a conversation that was like, do we want to include, or, you know, there's a lot of this stuff that I'm still writing is more guidance on how to play and run the game. It's things like, how do you customize Realis? It's some house rules suggested and stuff like that, or potential variation rules and stuff like that. And so we had a conversation, Tyler, that was like, how much of the stuff that's kind of in bullet point format right now in the playtest doc should I punch up and put into this Ashcan? And we kind of went back and forth on it. I think we both kind of could feel out the arguments for both sides. It wasn't like you had one thought and I had one thought. But then you suggested, Tyler, you're like, I think you can get away with just this one page that ends with the call to action. Because the game suggests ways to hack it itself, or to make it your own already. And so you can just leave it there. We don't need in the Ashcan to have 5 pages of optional rules, or, you know, here's how to diagram a sentence. The game does that already. You know, here's how to build an NPC. Now, that's stuff that I would love to revisit for the full release. But I think, Tyler, you were 100% right. Obviously now, Brian having called it out, that was the kind of the period to end it, to end that section of the game on.
Well, let me be clear. Yeah. That was not a period. That was an exclamation point, right, my guy.
yes.
Yeah, I think that, like, it makes me think back to my days in theater, because I worked as a literary manager and dramaturg for about a decade before the pandemic kind of forced a career shift. That and the success of Beak, Feather, and Bone, just kind of naturally leaning into that. But when I was doing dramaturgy, a lot of that is new play development. So I was doing a lot of editing for plays the same way an editor would do that for a novel. I also would do a good bit of book design, both for a small press that I started and ran called Plays in Verse,
two words, plays, inverse, where I would publish experimental theater that usually wouldn't get distribution because it was so weird. A lot of times plays only get published and distributed beyond the, like, you know, the storefront that they happened in or the big theater or the high school gymnasium or whatever, if they are attractive for an acting audition. So a lot of times it's the plays that you can recreate over and over and over again and make money off royalties that get published, as opposed to publishing them like I was doing, like a book of poetry. It was like, hey, it doesn't matter if one person produces this or no one ever produces this again. It's interesting as literature. And one of the things that would be a discussion I would have early on with playwrights when I was formatting these scripts for print, for distribution, was like, all right, what's the vocabulary of design that we want to have here? You know, when words are italic, does that mean it's happening off stage? When words are bold, does that mean it's a sound cue or a light cue? You know, when we are formatting the text, when we are thinking about like how we want to present the text in a way that clearly communicates this is a stage direction and this is a spoken line, you know, how do we want to do that? And a lot of playwrights would say to me like, well, you know, what's the normal way to do it? Which is a far less interesting thing to me, because you can really do it any way you want. And as long as you're consistent about it, as you read a play, it's going to teach you how to read it. As long as you are kind of give some upfront notes and then are very consistent in your vocabulary of design, by the end of the play, like, it's going to be an immersive experience where you're just kind of scanning the page and it's going straight to your mind's eye. And then in experimental theater, if and when you break those rules, precisely because you've been so consistent, it'll really stand out of like, hey, this is an intentional choice being made. This is not a typo. This is not like an error on the formatter's part. Like, I understand how this works on the page. And so now that it's doing something different, I should pay attention. And I think that the design, you know, from a gameplay design perspective, but also as I was doing layout on the text itself, part of that work, especially for something that is like an introduction to this game, to this world, but is also meant to be a functional text, this is not just us saying like, hey, here's a taste and wait for more, you know, if you're interested. And there is going to be more, but this is enough to run a campaign. This is enough to like fully engage with Realis, not just on the starter level, but like through those sentence retirements. And because we were so aware of like what we were trying to do and what our priorities were and what we wanted to communicate to the players in every other part of the text, that once we got to that kind of like GM guidance, you know, hey, what do we need to flag as exceptions to the rules type thing? A lot of that work had already been done for us, because it really was just kind of shouting out, one, here are like the few kind of things that we might not have covered. And two, like, hey, this is a permission structure for you to break the rules and make this game your own. You know, it is not like against the spirit of the thing if you see a way that like tokens are used or sentences are realized and you decide that something different works better for your party. In those cases, I would just encourage someone to be consistent, you know, be a game designer and don't just like fudge the rules when it's convenient. Like, find the style of play that works best for your Realis table and be like, okay, in our campaigns, our house rules are this. And the game does a lot of that already. Yeah.
There's a play group that was a playtesting group that, for instance, I think still chooses a different point in time when tokens get spent. So as written, so player characters, I guess players have tokens that they can spend to temporarily boost the reality, the rank of a sentence from a +0 to a +1, from +1 to a +2, etc. The tokens can do some other stuff too, including adding new moon sentences or using moon sentences. As written, the actor has to say whether or not they're spending their token when they declare their action. So if you say, I'm going to smash that bug knight into the ground with, I always have an exotic weapon or whatever the hell, but whatever the duelist sentences is. I always have like a special and distinct sentence. Is that what it is? Or special and distinct weapon? Yeah, I always wield a beautiful and distinct weapon. That's what it is. Let's say you want to do that. but you don't know what the Bug Knight's sentence is that they're going to try to, you know, counter you with. You might go, ooh, you know what? I'm going to spend up the token to get it up to plus one. I know that there's a group where they wait to spend tokens for the actor until after the counteractor declares their sentence. So that the actor can then go, ooh, that sounds like a plus one sentence to me, or a plus whatever sentence. I'm going to try to boost it to beat it. And that's like such a, just a different tonal space, because it gives authority back to the actor. It lets the actor, the person who's acting first, have a lot of extra power in any sort of exchange. It takes a lot away from the person defending. And the way the word rights see the world, the defender, the counteractor, passivity has preference. Like the world is biased towards the person acting second, not the person acting first. And so that's why the rule is that in the book. But if you want to imagine Rialis a different way, you can just do it. And they do it, and they like it that way. And I'm happy that like it works for them. And I have no, you know, that is such a clear, good, universal rule that every – and it works the other way too. It means that GM characters and moon sentences, when the GM is spending them in faction sentences, get to get their – I guess they don't actually have tokens. But, you know, as the actor, they get to know what the response is going to be in the same way, right? So there is – as long as it's kind of a universal application, I think it makes sense. I do still get a lot of people DMing me or messaging me on Blue Sky or leaving comments that are like, would it be okay if I did this? And it's like, I'm not at your table. You could do whatever. Sometimes the question is more like, will this break anything? And I try to answer those as like definitively as possible. But I have definitely had people been like, is it okay if I give people two tokens? I get, yeah, awesome. Go for it. Like, let me know how it goes, because I haven't done it, you know, or there was a moment where the people had a lot of tokens, but it was a completely different design at that point, basically. But like, all right, you tell me how it goes. I'm excited to hear about it. You know, you don't need my permission.
And I think there's a difference between a game that like in those GM guidance sections kind of like apologizes for itself. And says like, hey, so this might be a little hard. So if you and your little, you know, your little friends don't want a game this harsh, then here's a way to change it. Versus a game that is just like clear, concise, and says, you know, outright, like, these are the rules of the game, but also, you know, it's out of my hands. As soon as you have it, do what you want.
There's a confidence you can feel in the text as you read this game.
I want to talk about the page 103, which is Running Rialis, that has a thing called the Only Unchanging Rule. And what I love about this section is that it is so, as Elliot was saying, so confident and clear in what Rialis is. And it kind of says like, hey, if you're used to an oppositional style of play, this isn't necessarily the game. Here's what Rialis is. Here's where its strengths are. And then the line at the end, which I also love, and I'll just read verbatim. Thus, this is the first sentence and the only sentence a GM must never, ever change. I always play with and not against my players. And again, exclamation point at the end of the page.
Yeah, 100%. It just doesn't work, right? It's just not that game. And this is a hard-learned rule, right? Or a hard-learned, you know, advice is I've tried to run it in a more oppositional manner. It doesn't work. Your player has, I always kill my foe. You know, I always kill my foe too, but you can't easily use it in the same way, because chances are you are acting and the player is responding. That's like a very natural kind of structure for the conversation at the table at the beginning of a game, because of the history of tabletop games. And so you might try to break that out and then realize, oh, I lost this fight because my enemy has, I always get you to break up with your boyfriend, and now your boyfriend hates you. And so you're thinking about your boyfriend breaking up with you. And so now you missed the attack on me, whatever, right? Like you're going to not necessarily win those encounters. And more importantly, the game will get into a sort of tit for tat that slows things down. And if you're trying to play oppositionally, generally, you kind of have a game plan, and that game plan will not work. Someone will come up with something because of how broad sentences are at the beginning, especially, that will surprise you, or they'll move the circumstances in a way that surprise you, that you can't resolve that surprise with, well, guess what? My guy has a plus seven on his attack, and so he's going to be able to beat you in the one-on-one fight. Like, that doesn't – it's just not here. And so that sort of, this is like bracketing the entire thing of like, as a GM, I fundamentally like to play with and not against my players. I know there are tables out there where everybody involved has a lot of fun playing against. They like doing the sort of tactical challenge. I know players who hate when a GM fudges dice rolls in their favor. I know players who want to feel like they're playing Final Fantasy Tactics versus mode. Like, I think I'm one of many people who thinks that D&D 4th edition actually had some points and is a fun game in and of itself. I'm a 4th edition defender. I would love for there to be a really fun, cool digital version of 4th that we could all, like, play whenever we wanted to. That would be incredible, right? But that's not the games I tend to like to play on either side of the table, and that's not the mode I like to play in when I'm playing anything. And so it's kind of natural that I made a game that fits that mode. But as I tried to play it in different ways, I learned really quickly oppositional play is not as useful as kind of collaborative play with this set of – it's not as valid. It's not as viable as the sort of collaborative play and storytelling, to the degree that, you know, there's versions of this – document where I tried out using dramaturge or dramaturg or using editor as the word for GM throughout, because I think that's much closer to what the role is than other visions of what the GM is. In the end, I ended up going with GM for ease and, you know, straightforwardness. I think, Tyler, you and I might still have conversations about, do we want to rename certain things like PCs? And there's some benefit to it in terms of pushing the character of the book. The book is really flavorful, and it uses lots of terminology and words that help suggest something about the nature of the world. But I also knew it was a really new thing. And I think if you're looking at something that doesn't quite look like other tabletop games you've played, and also you have to internalize that GMs are called this other thing in this, and it's not something easy like MC in, you know, Apocalypse World, it's a little, going back to on-ramps, it's a little bit of a hard on-ramp. It's a little bit, it makes it a little bit harder for new players to think, oh, I could play this with my friends.
You've really got to pick your battles.
100%.
In those things.
It's funny, you know, I can't talk too much about the project, but at the time that I was making Realis, I started Realis a little bit before joining a video game company called Possibility Space, not Possible Worlds, different, two different possible things in my life at the same time. But at Possibility Space, we were making a game that was very interested in how do you get people on board with collaborative storytelling. It was a digital game. It was a video game. That project is completely canceled now. That studio's gone. But I had spent a lot of time thinking about that dilemma with a completely different design. It had nothing to do with Realis, completely different. But that sort of designs, being in that design space and thinking about how do I make sure the gates are open wide for people who don't think of themselves as capable of playing something like this. Two different kind of audiences, you know, one is video game players. And in this case, it's people who maybe know my work, know Tyler's work. Maybe they know Tyler's work for one-shots, but they've not played a big campaign game. They've played Beak Feather and Bone. They've played Scene Thieves, but they haven't played something that's like a continuing ongoing campaign. Or they know my work, but they've only played Forge in the Dark and PBTA games and D&D or something, and they've not played something that's diceless before. How do I make those people feel comfortable here? And being able to be like GMs, players, player characters, NPCs is pretty clear. You know, I fought my battles with things like they're called moons and not locations or settings or something. You know, those are the places. I fought my battles by having classes named things like the esoteric, you know, and the peregrine.
And the syzygist.
And the syzygist, yes, exactly that, yeah.
It is a needle to thread, though, trying to figure out what is the right balance of, like, this is one for the sickos, and we don't want this to be a game only for the sickos, you know? Like, we don't want to shave the corners off what makes the game special, but also we want to make sure that, like, you know, first and foremost, it is a language of invitation that the game is being written in, that is like, hey, this game is going to require things of you, you know, to play it, you know.
Yeah, it's an active posture game. It is not a lean back, use your abilities game, for sure. You know,
it's very much a like, hey, trust us, do it this way, and there will be results. And in order for, you know, to earn that trust from players, there's a certain amount of like clarity that you need to have. And you also need to get them right into, you know, the like the role-playing and the storytelling process and like the refining process of what makes Rialis special, so that early on they see like, oh, I get it now. I get why it works this way instead of the other way. Instead of, you know, so many role-playing games, I feel like you have to get to session 5 and like you've, you know, you've found your consistent babysitter and, you know, it's always Thursdays and you're finally like, oh, I get it. I get what makes this different from other campaign style games. Whereas Rialis kind of like throws you right in a way that can be like different, but ideally isn't jarring.
You're kind of turning people into sickos rather than just inviting the sickos.
That's the dream. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sicko Maker 5000, so, you know?
That's the subtitle.
Yeah, yeah,
Rialis,
yeah.
Sicko Maker 5000.
Yeah, that's actually the next game I'm making, Sicko Maker 5000. It's card-based.
I would buy that no matter what the pitch was.
Midnight Musketeers is a cozy dark tabletop role-playing game where light and shadow intertwine in a fractured world. Players take on the roles of Marmiteers, brave adventurers who journey into the untamed Wildernight to collect the elusive Midnight Musketeers, craft magical jams, and protect the fragile light of Nim. Through collaborative storytelling and resourceful gameplay, players weave tales of courage, community, and the pursuit of balance. Will you preserve the light, uncover the truths hidden in the shadows, or reshape the balance of the world forever? Midnight Musketeers is perfect for fans of Studio Ghibli and Sea of Stars, who seek to capture the magic of exploration and the heartfelt adventure in a world where small heroes make a big impact. Play Midnight Musketeers as a traditional GM'd game, GM-less, or even solo. Midnight Musketeers is crowdfunding now on BackerKit. Join the campaign at pandeongames.com/musketeers.
I'm Quinns of tabletop role-playing game review show Quinns Quest, and this is Play to Find Out. Play to Find Out is an actual play podcast that brings notorious old games from the 80s and 90s back to the table. Each season of Play to Find Out, I'm joined by Emily Johnson and Rob Morgan.
Good? Nervous?
Yeah.
You both looked at each other really concerned, like you think what's about to happen is going to be unpleasant. And frankly, I think that's rude. And together, we explore the TTRPGs of ages gone by. Our goal? To separate the TTRPGs that deserve to be remembered from those that maybe don't.
Can I
don't know, Emily. It was the 80s. A lot of people were on cocaine. We blow the dust from decrepit systems to learn how they work.
Your 100 on the encounter table bursts out. Right, you've encountered a bug. Get ready. Don't laugh.
How does one get ready for a fog?
Don't laugh.
Encounter their unique quirks.
I do finger guns to cover up how I wince.
A weird thing happens as you do finger guns.
Oh, no.
And I'm hoping that the Quinns Quest community will join us in exploring these games too. If you f*** this up, cannot describe to you how much your adventure ends here.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because the best way to learn is to play to find out. Play to Find Out is available now on the Quinns Quest Patreon, but the first episode of each series streams for free on the Quinns Quest YouTube channel and wherever you get your podcasts. Anyway, you failed the Earth Tech roll, and you made jokes while I was doing my exposition, so you don't get to hear any more.
Oh, no. Come on.
I was shook.
So I want to get into a little bit pulling away from like the details of this game and talk about this collaboration between two incredible creatives and how and why this came to be. I think the why is maybe a little more interesting me to start. On Tyler's front, why is Rialis a Possible Worlds game? And on Austin's front, why is Possible Worlds the right home for Rialis? And maybe Tyler, we start with you.
Yeah, so I'll say that like I'm very lucky and very grateful
to have, you know, gotten to a place where Possible Worlds Games is my full-time job. You know, I make these games, sell them, print them, publish them, etc. But I know that I have my strengths as a designer. One, I like making shorter games. Part of that is because I want to make sure that they are games that are able to be like played in the course of an evening. I want to price them affordably. I also, you know, I have obsessive compulsive disorder. So a lot of times, like, a smaller project is something that is easier for me to look at it and be like, okay, you know, I'm going to do one thing and I'm going to do it well. And I'm not going to get caught up in everything else. And then also my games, you know, something that I've found about myself as a designer, as I continue to like stretch and grow, et cetera, is that a lot of my games kind of start from zero. You know, they're like, all right, everyone, we're coming into the room together. Here are our tools. And we're going to kind of like start from scratch and make a world together, characters together, a story together. And a lot of that comes from my devised theater background, which is a way of playwriting where you just kind of gather collaborators in a room and you play a bunch of design and acting exercises until you find something that, like, you know, feels interesting or different, or, you know, just like you get momentum on an idea and you keep rolling with it. That's how a lot of my games are played. And so there is something that is very much like, hey, this is an opportunity for me to work on something that has a lot more of an authorial voice, you know, which is something that, like, I've edited plenty of plays like that before, but it's something that, like, it feels different in a way that is very refreshing. You know, I'm able to kind of work out that other side of my game designer brain without necessarily being the primary mover. But the biggest reason why Possible Worlds Games is publishing, you know, not only Realis, but also a variety of games by other designers. Elliot, you and I share Vidya Valetti. I will be publishing, you know, honestly, more people need to get on the Vidya train.
For real.
Because none of the people that I'm publishing am I expecting, like, oh, you know, exclusive relationship. They're only publishing games with Possible Worlds. There are a lot of game designers out there that love making games and hate running an LLC. You know, they do not like the process of learning to be the singer-songwriter, producer that, you know, our scene really expects people to be until they get to a certain point in their career when maybe someone's willing to lend them a helping hand. I want to, you know, work with designers and be able to say, like, hey, I have, like, the development side figured out. I have the printing, fulfillment, distribution side figured out. And I think that your game would be a good fit for our catalog. And a lot of times that can look like a different size of game, shape of game, et cetera. I'm really just looking for games with engaging themes and unique mechanics, or unique themes and engaging mechanics. It really works either way. But I'm going to be publishing more and more games by other people. One, to kind of like take that burden so that they can, you know, focus on like actually making the game and getting it out there for them so that, you know, it'll boost their portfolio, help them get work on other games, and also so that I can cut them checks for those sales. But with Possible Worlds Games, more and more I will go to conventions, and I'm kind of a victim of my own success in that people will come to my booth. And whereas in previous years, they would be like, oh my gosh, who are you? What is this? Oh, give me, you know, I'll take these two. And then they'll come back and they'll be like, oh, I really enjoyed playing those two games. Like, give me the other ones that you have. I would have a lot of people coming to my booth now saying, like, I love your games. You know, I'm wearing my Possible Worlds Games shirt. Like, here's a story of a table that I had. What's new? And I tell them it's one game and it's $15. And they're like, great, see you in a year. Which is, in a lot of ways, like a much more energizing interaction. You know, someone coming to my booth and like already knowing, you know, not having to like do the used Bible salesman thing and like really convince them that, no, I'm not trying to take D&D away from you. But I know that, like, in order for my business to remain sustainable, I can either burn myself out by making a lot more games than I have the time and energy for, or I can start publishing other people.
I can build out our catalog. I can say to people when they come to my table, here's a new game by me. So if you like my previous games, you'll like this. But also, here is a game by someone that I'm vouching for. Here is a game that is aligned with these projects in this way. Like, oh, if you like the map-making world-building of Beak, Feather, and Bone, here's another game that goes about world-building in a different way. Or if you're looking for a campaign-style game, let's talk about Realis, things like that. But as far as the why of Realis in particular, like why Possible Worlds Games is the right fit for Realis, I'll throw that one to Austin because I asked you the exact same question when you were like, hey, so what if Possible Worlds Games published Realis? And I was like, well, what if?
Which was forever ago, actually, right? In some ways, you know, we...
Because the first time you asked, like, I did not say yes right away. I was like, Austin, are you sure that this is the right fit for the game? Or are you saying this because we have established a friendship outside of games? And also, like, I'm in the playtesting server.
You were in the playtesting
server. Which can be part of it.
Partly because of the same reasons that you made a great partner for publishing Realis, right? Which I was introduced to you through Beak, Feather, and Bone, which we played on Friends of the Table forever ago. We then went on to play a bunch of other stuff that you'd made, which was great. And then because of that, you know, we started, you know, anytime you were in New York, we'd get breakfast. Or if I was at a convention where you were, I'd swing by the table or whatever, right? But along the way, part of what I came to know, especially during the playtesting era, more of your expertises, more of your experiences. You already talked about some of the things that I think made you a great fit for, let's just say, editor even of the game, for the Ashcan at least, which was your experience with theater, your experience with poetry, your experience in literature already, because I knew that you would bring those aspects into understanding the game and making sure that it was legible and making sure I didn't back off of those things in favor of breadth or something. And then on top of that, your experience with on the publishing side was of those things and not of just games made me confident that we would, again, you've already hit all of this, you would think about things like italics and headers in ways that were not just in the sort of traditional game sense, which is something I might want for a different game. You know what I mean? But for Realis specifically, I think maybe an important thing to think about for me or to say about Realis, again, I started Realis before I took that other job and spent years working on the game for Possibility Space. That game was as mass market as it needed, as it could be. That was the goal. Realis was one for me, right? For the sickos, asterisk me, right? And so I needed to make sure we found a publishing partner who would really understand that and would push that as the core identity of the game. And I, you know, just came to trust Tyler for that. I obviously have some relationships with other publishers. I talked to a couple other people about potentially doing different parts of it over the years. But I always kind of felt like Possible Worlds was making stuff that was in line with those big goals of what Realis was. And I also felt like Friends of the Table is a large podcast. It's a successful podcast. It is not a giant podcast. It is successful by the metrics that it is able to you know, pay 8 people, which Friends of the Table is 8 people, enough money to count as like an income. Not a great income, but it's an income. And that's, we're incredibly lucky to have it. We are incredibly happy to have the support that we have. But we are not the giant video-focused, filmed on set actual play podcast. You know, we record on Discord and someone edits the show together. Allie edits the show together on Audacity. Keith edits Media Club Plus, our fun anime show where currently it's not just an anime show, but right now they're finishing up Hunter x Hunter. It'll go into other really cool things right after Hunter x Hunter is done. We are a professional podcast. We're really proud about that. But our ethos and my ethos has been about trying to make stuff that you at home can make and make you understand that you can do this. I'm not saying that that's the limits or the goals of Possible Worlds necessarily, but I knew that you wouldn't start at how do we move as many of these as possible. We would get to how do we make a really cool book? How do we make something that has like, do we want fun pack-ins? How do we want to do a crowdfunding campaign, et cetera? But I knew you would start with how do we make something that's really cool, that's something that is in line with the identity of the game. And that identity of the game is the sort of thing that I don't think I came up with because I'm some games genius. In fact, I think it's probably came out of me because it's the first thing that I've designed at this scale. It's kind of amateurish in many ways, in the positive sense, right? It's a real, well, why don't we just do this type thing that doesn't come from years of making, you know, modules for another game and becoming kind of enculturated in that particular view of what a game can be. Obviously, I'm enculturated in what a game can be. I've played a bunch of stuff. I'm deep in the PBTA and Forge in the Dark Mines. Like, all that stuff is true. But I haven't been writing stuff for those settings. I haven't been, like, maker for those games. I haven't been building games in those models. And so I think it's a pretty amateurish, not quite outsider art way, but, you know, it's the sort of like, well, why not just do this thing? Let's just see if it works. And then sometimes it works, right? And I think so many of the games that Tyler had made were those sorts of ideas and towards that sort of audience. You know, I was always captivated by Possible World's pitch of the, what is the actual name of the set of six small games, Tyler?
Yeah, it was just our Possible World's
collection,
box set,
right? Yeah. Which were like games you designed to play with your brother who's a farmer and who does not play other types of games, really. And that attitude, even if that's not literally the attitude I wanted for Realis, the ability to take that attitude and not, it's not about dumbing it down. It's not about talking down to an audience. It's about identifying what the breadth of what play can be was exactly what I wanted to bring, excuse me, to Realis. And Tyler was able to do that, you know? So I think it's been a wonderful fit. I'm super excited for people to see what we do next in terms of putting out a more full edition. Tyler and I have been in contact with lots of artists over the last week or two. So the things are rolling ahead. And I could not be more excited about being part of a lineup that includes so many incredible people. The upcoming games all seem sick. I have not gotten to secretly play any of them or anything, but the pitches are incredible and I'm very excited to try them out.
Yeah, to talk about like the wider catalog, I think that what Austin said about like this is someone's first RPG, you know, how no matter how much time you've spent in the space, this is like the first opportunity for you to be like, all right, as someone with a steady diet of tabletop role-playing games, both the criticism of them, you know, like capital C academic and lowercase c, like what are the reviews saying? But also, you know, like playing a lot of games, hacking a lot of games, creating seasons, etc. It's been very interesting to me as an editor and as someone who works in like literary management and has for 15 years now that it's kind of like carrying over into my game stuff. I always had a lot more fun developing a new play by a poet who had never written a play before. I was like, hey, you have a command of voice, or you have a very physical sense, or a lot of your poems are very kind of like monologue or dialogue adjacent, where my role as an editor was not teaching someone how to say something that no one else has said before. It was, they're already saying things that no one else has said before. I'm just helping them realize here are the tools that a play as a text allows you. You know, here are the unique things that are inherent in this as a piece of genre that you can do. And also reassuring people that like, hey, not everything needs to go in this play. You know, you can write other plays. So working with Austin has been really great in that, you know, he has a lot of context, is a great thinker, is a great writer. But it's been a lot of like, all right, this is someone who's had a steady diet of tabletop role-playing games. How can I help them kind of focus that down into like, what is the most Austin Walker game possible? Or, you know, once we've kind of identified that, what are some of those more basic things that you don't really think about during the design process of like, hey, we need a paragraph up top that immediately tells people if they need like pieces of paper and pencils and things like that, and how many players, you know, the game supports, etc. But the same way that it's been really fun working with Austin on that, I'm also going to be working on, well, I am working on games by James D'Amato and Drew, also of the One Shot podcast. They have collaborated together on the game Cosmic Century Nights, which is another really cool game that is in kind of a science fantasy, you know, milieu, but approaches things in such different ways with such different mechanics. And that, again, is really a reflection of the one-shot network, like their diet of games. You know, it is something that is very much like random generation, roll characters, like jump right in, take big swings right away. It is, whereas Friends at the Table is very much like, all right, you know, collaborative storytelling, kind of slow burn, characters change for the better or worse over time, you know, kind of the one-shot ethos of like, hey, we're going to get in and we're going to make an impression. And maybe it'll go for like a couple of episodes. You know, they have their more campaign focused stuff, but they don't know quite how much attention they're going to have. So they're like, all right, every episode is going to be big and important. And then I'm also working on a game by Jeff Stormer of Party of One that is canonize, that is essentially a book club in a game, where a lot of what you do is the players will identify like what are pieces of media that are important to them or resonate with them, and they give their fellow players homework. You know, you break after that session zero and everyone goes and they like, they watch the TV show or they listen to the song or album or they read the short story, and then they come back and the act of play is, you know, doing world building with those items and kind of establishing in your setting, what are all the ways that these are like secretly connected to each other? How are they all part of the same story, or how do they reflect this larger story that exists in the margins? And that is really interesting to me, just, you know, as an extension of Jeff and the way that he will play these one-on-one games with people. And I've said before, he is like an RPG sommelier, where he's like, ooh, this is a bottle that I've had in the basement for a long time, and I've been waiting to break it out for the one person that would really enjoy it.
Jeff is so good.
And it's just sometimes instead of a bottle of wine, that's like, you know, a weird like baby talk game or something. It's like, yes, you are the person who gets Binky 5000, the hot new RPG.
Jeff and I just sat down to record an episode for the first time. I don't think we've ever actually been on the same thing together, despite following each other's work for years. And it felt like a sommelier or like an omakase chef being like, oh, I have a course prepared for you. I'm ready to just lay it all out for you. Like, I know exactly not just what to pair you with, but like, this is going to be the most like tight, perfectly paced 90 minutes to 2 hours of a game that you've ever had. I cannot wait for Jeff's game.
Yeah. And so like, you know, that is part of what makes me excited about this expansion. You know, like, I am happy to be able to be in a position where I can write people checks, and, you know, it is definitely going to benefit Possible Worlds games and like my own personal finances and job security and things like that. But it's really nice to get back to that place of these close artistic collaborations that I had for years and years in the theater, and then really kind of lost when I started writing my own games, because a lot of how I made it sustainable at first was by doing everything on my own. And I had the skill set from running a publishing company to be like, well, I can design the game and also handle like pricing out, manufacturing and fulfillment and stuff like that. But this is the first time in a long time that I've felt like, oh, I am in my comfort zone, because learning to do conventions, learning how to like be proud of my own writing was a much heavier lift for me than being like, oh yeah, I get to like meet with Austin every other week and make this cool game that like both of us are excited about and pay artists to bring it to life. Like, that's, you know, that's what I've been working towards.
I would say that is also a big part of it is Tyler, I know how much you've been itching to flex these particular muscles again. And I knew that this was not a, you know, we had some conversations that were explicitly about like, I want Possible Worlds to be something in addition to a place where you can publish your own games that you design. But like, and you've started doing that a little bit already. Obviously, but like part of the thing that was like fun to work with you on this was like, let's tackle a big one. Let's see what like 150 pages looks like. It's certainly the biggest printed thing that I've made, right? That's released anyway. And so like, working with you on that, being able to lean on your expertise is without that, without ever feeling like you secretly wanted to be designing the game. Do you know what I mean? In other contexts, I've worked with publishers who like want to get more involved with something than be the publisher. That happens a lot in the world of video games, right? Where a publisher thinks that they understand the game you're making more than you do, or more than the creative director does on the game, or thinks that there's a market opportunity that you should be chasing or whatever. And that stuff, especially in the age of AI, I was making this game that I was making before at the height of NFTs, you know, those conversations can be brutal. And obviously, I would never believe Tyler would push us down that road particularly. But I also knew, like, from conversations with him that he wanted the big project to try to publish as its publisher, not something that would be mistaken as a Possible Worlds game designed by Tyler Crumrine because it says Possible Worlds on it or something like that, right? You wanted to bring the best out of what it was. So I've kind of said that now 8 times, but it's still true.
It's also fun.
Yeah,
you totally. Know?
And like, it's fun.
It's been enjoyable.
Yeah. Hell yeah. I mean, you can see, I mean, anybody who's been listening to this conversation, you can see how much fun the two of you are having making this game. Like, you can hear totally. It. Like, it's...
Yeah, it's great it's to just great. Sit back and watch two people gas each other up. That's great.
That's what we're doing.
Well, yeah, we're pretty cool, yeah. I guess.
Pretty cool. I mean, what's great about it is you can still play...
The bad boys of indie RPGs.
You can still play humble if you have somebody else gassing you up. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's true.
You think we don't play that game exactly. all the time?
this is why you do a duo, you know?
That's why you have a co-host, yeah. baby.
Exactly. Why you're the co-host. So kind of as we bring this conversation to a close, I want to ask about, you know, people have this Ashcan, and like you said, like, you can go play a full campaign with this Ashcan. You can run it, and you can make this Ashcan your favorite game and your long-term campaign game. What can people start to get excited about for, like, the eventual full release of this game? What are the goodies and exciting bits that people should, like, get excited about?
I'm going to start with something that has nothing to do with me outside of curation and some creative direction, which is the art. The book as it stands has an incredible cover by Adesk. It has incredible interior art by Sam Beck. Those are both established pieces. The cover art is something for the current cover of the Realis Patreon campaign for Friends at the Table, where we're playing through the game. It's early playtesting, but it's still the game. And the interior art is from a postcard series. A certain tier of patrons over at friendsofthetable.cash get access to monthly postcards with microfiction written on them by me or Jack DeKeat, the composer and co-writer of these postcards, also a member of Friends of the Table. And so that art was all already done, right? That was previous art about the world, about some of the factions, etc. We are commissioning a ton of new art for this game, and it's going to be incredible. I like the people we're working with. It is an incredible range of folks. I'm really excited for people to. I'm really excited to see what everything get made over the next, you know, few months, over the next, you know, year or so or whatever, as people put stuff together. And that's going to be a huge boon to making the game feel even more flavorful, to making the classes pop, to making the factions pop, to making the moons pop. Then number two, the stuff that I am responsible for is a lot more of those things, a lot more classes, a lot more moons, a lot more factions. There is not half of what is in the playtest doc in this Ashcan. There are more than twice as many classes. There are more than twice as many NPCs. There are more than twice as many moons. Actually, that is true on the moons. That is true.
Yeah, no, sorry. It's yes. true.
I'm also writing more moons.
There's more than
3 times as many moons right now. There's only 3 moons in the... I guess there's a secret 4th moon in the playbook, or in the Ashcan.
Yeah.
If you dig for it, there's a 4th one that's spread throughout the text secretly that you could put together and find. But there are going to be way more moons. There's going to be way more factions and NPCs and classes. And there's going to be some amount of material helping guidance on how to play and run the game. I think I've seen a lot of people run it successfully. I've also had a lot of people ask me questions that feel like the text answers them, but it clearly doesn't, right? In terms of realization timing, in terms of how you prep for a one-shot, how you prep NPCs in general. You know, for me, my hope was, look at the NPCs that are here in this list or in this book. You'll see that some of them are listed with sentences that are already plus one or plus two sentences, right? So that means you can do that for your own NPCs. But I've still had people ask me, should I already have sentences at plus one? Should I already have da 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 da? And that's a totally fine question to ask me. It means the text isn't clear enough about that, which I knew it wasn't because there's no GMing section in this book. There's just there's some content, there's enough to run with, but there's not like a big breakdown on that stuff. So some of that stuff will be in there. I do have a handful of optional rules that I'd like to include. I will say that I am cautious about, I have like big optional rule ideas, but I might not include them all in the book because I don't want to undercut what the identity of the game is, if that makes sense, right? One of the biggest and best pieces of advice I got early on in this game, there was an early draft where I spent a lot of time saying stuff like, sentences are sort of like skills from other games, or unlike other games, you don't roll dice to resolve da-da-da-da-da. And the piece of advice I got, and actually the actual key was actually, I had Lines and Veils written very clearly as a particular part of the session zero write-up. And the two notes I got were, this game is constantly apologizing for what it is. It's constantly saying, sorry that this is different than D&D. I mean, not literally D&D, but, you know, that style of game. And then two, are you sure Lines and Veils are the right safety tool for this game? They're totally fine to use if a play group uses them and they're comfortable with that, that's totally fine. But are you just stapling in something else? And so instead, I ended up writing foundation sentences, which are, you know, sort of like Lines and Veils, except they use the same language as the rest of sentences in Realis. So, our story always does blank, or our story never does blank, or our story always with care and consideration does blank, right? A good example for this is one of the sessions that I've played, or one of the playtests I've played, had our story always shows where the blade goes, but never shows it go in, which is to say it's interested in violence. It's interested in even pretty clear depictions. It's not just I slashed my sword at the enemy. It's like, I did blank with the sword, but we don't have to stay on it. We don't have to zoom in on it. We don't have to like be gruesome about it. And so building that tool then made me also go, wait a second, I should, this is what the word rights would have written. The word rights would not have apologized for the game being what it is. And so I got rid of a lot of that sort of early guidance about how this game isn't like other games, and that made the game way stronger. And so I'm a little cautious about what optional rules I put in, because I don't want to put in optional rules that then become the de facto way to play the game because I put in an optional dice rule or something. And everyone's like, oh, well, I like games with dice, so I'm just going to play it with dice. I want people to try to play the game the way it's there, you know? What I will still include probably is a page or two about how to tweak things for a shorter campaign, or hey, if you're interested in seeing a world where, you know, the active posture is rewarded instead of the passive posture, switch when tokens get spent, stuff like that. So optional rules will be in there in some regard, along with a bunch of other GMing stuff. And I suspect I'll add some stuff that is strictly lore. You know, capital L, here is some more details about the world. Obviously, there will be a lot more of that simply by the nature of there being more classes and factions and stuff. You know, y'all don't even know about the entire order of non-assassins that exist inside of this this setting, right?
Yes.
Non-assassins.
You
know, that they're important, you know? And like, that's not a thing that's in this book. So there's going to be more capital L lore even just through that stuff. But I do have material written that's like, what is Realis? And there's some of it I'll include. Maybe it'll end up being redacted in some ways. I'm not 100% sure yet. But like, there will be enough to wet the whistle and make people ask questions and fill in their own answers about what things are, you know?
I think you've sufficiently wetted my whistle with non-assassins. So everything else is just gravy.
Yeah.
I'll say to like give a bit of a ditto to everything Austin said. But one of the things that like we, before, you know, Possible Worlds was even part of the publishing like conversation, but just when you were like kind of pitching me on the game, and as we were like talking about like, oh, what do I like about the game? What do you like about the game? A game that we both have in common as something that we really enjoy is Electric Bastionland. And the fact that like so much of that book is just random weirdos, and each weirdo gets their own like cool illustration. So there are, you know, definitely this is a game that we've talked very highfalutin about how it will teach you to be a better storyteller and how it like creates all this room for different kinds of agency and things like that. This is also going to be a game where like you're going to be able to randomly select a weirdo and just be like, all right, what does it mean that I am playing, you know, this nun assassin that has their own like identity and motivations that are never what I would have chosen for them, but like it's, you know, choose your character on the like Street Fighter select screen. So, and then it's also just like, it's going to be a beautiful book. It's going to be a functional book. And I'm really now, as we are getting closer and closer to the actual, you know, manufacturing of it all, I'm really paying a lot of attention to creating a book intended for a life on the shelf as well as in the hand. You know, I want this to be something that like is a tool that you can use at the table, but also something that just like looks sick and is a good conversation piece. Because part of the joy of publishing any kind of print literature is celebrating it. And so I'm going to be making sure that we are being intentional about like doing that and not just kind of cranking out like, here's the same thing, but more. It's like, no, we're also like giving it the like the HD treatment.
For the book freaks.
For sure. We aren't, what I think I want to say we're not going to throw away, and maybe this is useful for people who are making moons and classes and stuff like that, which we really encourage. Tyler and I had a big conversation about whether we wanted to totally revamp the core kind of layout, like design direction.
Like down to typesetting, like what is the font body?
There's stuff that will change and get you know, zhuzhed up a little bit in some ways, for sure. We are really excited about the person we're working with, who's going to work with Tyler on doing a lot of that additional interior design work. But we decided not to throw out the core identity of the game in the Ashcan, which is based on the classic Explorer template. Again, this is something that you could go get and start laying out your own book and put your own spin on it. I really wanted to emphasize that. But also the game did hit people when they opened it up. Like it has such a clear visual identity because of Tyler's layout work that I didn't want to throw that out. I think that identity is really sharp. And Tyler, you pointed out that also if we change it, there will be all of these supplements that were already written that kind of took that as the baseline of what Realis should quote unquote look like, and they might start feeling outdated. And so we really wanted to like, okay, we have an identity. We can maneuver it a little bit. We can add to it, but we shouldn't throw it out completely and replace it with something else. So that to me, I think is going to be an important thing. It's like there will be a through line of identity, even though there will be a ton of new material and some new design elements that really make it look, you know, incredible.
Because it's, you know, it's one of those things where like you use a font for a game or for a title because, you know, it felt like the right fit. And I really love the font that we use, Redaction. It was actually created, I think, for the Met. For some museum. For the MoMA. It was created for an exhibition at the MoMA PS1. It is a font that is inspired by the way that court documents, especially for like incarcerated Black folk or people that are, you know, arrested and then are manipulated through bail and things like that. But it is a font that is inspired by the way that like as you Xerox and copy and fax a document over and over and over, it doesn't matter if someone is doing the intentional malicious thing of like scratching out a body of text and officially redacting it as the law allows them to in some cases, doesn't in others. But if you kind of put something through a filter enough times, it gets redacted, you know, casually through, you know, the channels that it's being put through. And so this is a font that like has a history, has a purpose, has like the very clean, strong lines of the font and like the fun, like accents on it while still being a blockier font. But it is also something that like the font body for that is not just like, here's italic and here's bold, you know, it will like crunch. It will get pixelated. It will get redacted. And part of how we have done some of the like redaction flavor stuff in the text has been through like the official
font body. That is not me putting the text through a filter or something like that. But all that to say, like, it is a free font. It is a font that anyone can download and use. And the fact that people are seeing it and being like, this is the visual identity of Realis. And when I make my, you know, my fan moon or my fan class, I want it to be set in the way that, like, the real book is. You know, I think that that is such a nice, like, one, compliment to me as a designer, but two, it's a very small gift that you can give your audience of, like, choosing a design that is not impossible for them to replicate in a way that, like, adding, you know, world to your end of your title is like, I am part of the lineage of games that is, like, powered by the apocalypse, you know, or all the other little signifiers that people use. Like, my game uses MC, or my game uses referee. And it's a way to align yourself with, like, a tradition and a body of work. You know, in some ways, having a digestible design and having, like, accessible font assets is a way that you can say to the player, like, hey, if you do this, you know, you can make something that feels like a part of this. And that also reflects what Austin was saying, you know, Friends at the Table's priority on, you know, showcasing a style of play that you can replicate at home. You know, regardless of whether or not you have a subscriber base, you can play an RPG in a way where you are asking each other a lot of questions and you are inserting various games as mini games. You're, like, having session zeros and, like, aren't afraid to change something when it doesn't work. A lot of that kind of bleeds into my priorities as a, you know, a layout designer as well.
Can I give you one of the Nun Assassin sentences just as a teaser?
Just are as you kidding me? Are we going to say no to that?
All right. I always wield the slender tools of mercy.
Ooh. Ooh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nun Assassin.
Nun Assassin.
So up my alley.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So and if you weren't already plus one, I always wield the slender tools of mercy. When my awful boyfriend is wearing the little outfit.
Wears a little outfit. That might be a plus two. I, you know, it's.
Oh, yeah.
It when anybody wears the little outfit, you know, you just, you see the little outfit.
Really, it depends on, like, you know, was little an addition?
Right.
Maybe it's a plus
You're
three. Right. I used to have a regular size boyfriend.
That's right.
Oh, my God.
With that, thank you, Austin and Tyler, for coming to the table today. This was such a joy to talk to you both about Realis and about this collaboration. And I'm so excited for these Nun Assassins and all the other goodies. Do you want to let our listeners know where they can find both of you and where they can find and play Realis right now?
You can find me on, I guess, Blue Sky at this point at austinwalker.bsky.social. They need to have a better, it has to get better.
They gotta fix that.
You can go get Realis right now at thecalcutech.itch.io, or maybe it's just easier at this point to go to possibleworldsgames.com, where you can also sign up for the newsletter, Tyler's newsletter. I'm kind of stealing your plug here, Tyler, but people should go do that.
No, this is great.
Because that way they can see all the other stuff Possible Worlds is going to do. And there's a big link on the front page, as of the time of this recording, at least, to the Realis homepage. On that page, you can see a couple of different examples of play. I did obviously we were doing the Friends of the Table series on the game. There's an intro episode that's free for that. And then another set of four full episodes from the current Patreon exclusive arc, Friends of the Table.cash, for the whole arc that's still coming out. And so those are all available. And then there's also, I did a one shot with the folks over at Nextlander, Vinnie Caravella, Brad Shoemaker, and Alex Navarro, formerly of GiantBomb.com. I did a one shot with them that was, like, incredible, four hours long, that I think is a really great encapsulation of a multiplayer session deep into a campaign. You kind of pre-realized a bunch of sentences. So if you're interested in, like, what that can feel like, you can go listen to that or watch that. That's also in the Friends at the Table feed. They were gracious enough to give us the file for that. So you can go listen to that, friendsatthetable.net. I guess one other podcast shout out. If you read Realis and you get to the end of the book and you're like, wait a second, wait a second, this is Book of the New Sun. You're doing the Book of the New Sun thing. You can go listen to me over on Shelved by Genre with Michael Lutz and Cameron Kunzelman talk about Book of the New Sun for a bunch of episodes. It's a genre fiction podcast I also do. So go check that out.
And you can find me at PossibleWorldsGames.com. There will be links to whatever social media exists at the time as you listen to this. And yeah, I will continue to be active on, you know, the social media of note, whichever one hates people the least.
this week.
But the best way to find out about stuff is going to be going and just signing up for the newsletter. I generally don't send more than one like e-blast a month, but we've got a lot of games coming out and I'm going to be talking about them in a lot of different places. But the most consistent will always be the list of people who have affirmatively said, Tyler, I want to not miss out on this thing. So go and do that.
And having seen that list, you definitely don't want to miss out on those newsletter blasts because these games that are coming out are going to be awesome.
Yeah, a lot of really good stuff. We're already planned out through 2027. There are some games that we have not even announced yet that are still cooking. Some really exciting stuff. But there's part of the plan is also to, you know, like prove that this model can work. Prove that, you know, it is a good idea and it is also like a sustainable thing for more people to team up and kind of publish each other's works, kind of, you know, share their different abilities, let people use, you know, the right side or the left side of the brain, whatever kind of makes sense for their current life, workflow, etc. I'm really impressed by the fact, Elliot, that you are publishing A Land Once Magic, which is a fantastic game. I was in one of the first playtests of that. And like, this is the dream of seeing more creatives like coming together and publishing and promoting each other's work. Eventually, Possible Worlds Games will be at a place where it is accepting blind submissions. And ideally, if I do things right, and if, you know, I am loud enough about the advantages of this kind of artistic collaboration, a couple years down the line when I'm in the position to be taking more and more titles from early career designers, you know, unknown folks, et cetera, inevitably, I'm going to be rejecting 9 out of 10 things that are sent to me at least. But I really want to work towards a RPG landscape where when I have to reject someone, I am immediately saying like, hey, but you should consider taking this to More Blueberries. You should consider submitting this to this indie press. Or, hey, there's this journal of games that I feel like this would be a good place to like get this in front of people. This is not just a like, hey, Tyler's announced all the games that he's ever going to publish. This is me trying to be very intentional and be very loud about a kind of model of publishing and of like respect between artists that you can use too, that you can also be part of that lineage of, you know, not only making your own work, but like helping to get work out there for the people that you care about and believe in and admire.
Hell yes.
Let's make it happen.
Let's make it fucking happen. We're going to grow this industry one way or the other. I swear to God.
Bit by bit.
Thank you so much, Tyler and Austin, again, for coming to the table. And if you want more gaming content from us, you can check out the Many-Sided newsletter or become a member of the Many-Sided Media Discord. Both of those are linked in our show notes below. And if you want to help support this show, you can join the Many-Sided Media Patreon, get access to bonus actual plays from My First Dungeon, extended cast talkbacks, as well as roundtables and additional episodes of Talk at the Table. Please rate, review, and follow Talk at the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.